Koji is a venture capital firm cultivating community. This podcast is dedicated to cultivating conversations. Web 3.0 is democratizing the internet, and Koji Conversations is here to democratize access to the founders, investors, and creators building it from the ground up.
Dan Elitzer is co-founder of Nascent, a global multi-strategy investment firm focused on crypto and finance.
In this conversation with Dan, he shares how his experience working in East Africa exposed him to the social benefits of having open protocols for value exchange. He explains how this opened his mind to the possibility of a global internet money and eventually led him to co-found Nascent. Without further ado, here's our conversation with Dan. Dan, thank you so much for coming on High Definition. It's a pleasure to have you here. Would you be able just to start off with a little bit about yourself and your background?
Sure thing. So my name is Dan Elitzer. I am the co-founder of Nascent, which is a multi-strategy crypto investing entity. I grew up in New York in Western Massachusetts, did Pomona College for undergrad, studied psychology, and then ended up moving to Washington, D.C., looking to make a difference in some way. And that led me to an organization called Community Wealth Partners that was really focused on social enterprise and helping nonprofits and foundations figure out these kind of income generation strategies to support their mission. And I was absolutely unqualified for the job. Like, I was a psychology major. I hadn't done any business classes or econ or anything like that. But I got very fortunate to get my foot in the door with an internship and turn it into a job. And just really ended up going deep on what are some ways that we can play with different business models to achieve different outcomes. While I was there, I started getting more and more interested in international development. I ended up spending 9 months just traveling around Southeast Asia, India, East Africa, did a lot of volunteer work, including with Grameen Foundation, which is another nonprofit that's focused on microfinance and mobile technology to empower people. And I helped set up their office in Uganda. And then when I came back to DC, I ended up getting employed there on a full-time basis, doing finance and operations. And it was through my time kind of working in East Africa, especially, and seeing the rise of M-Pesa, which is the mobile money system there. And it really took off in Kenya in a way that it hadn't in many other countries, largely because there was a single carrier, Safaricom, which had about 70% market share.
Right.
And this probably isn't like widely known at now, but at the time, all of these mobile money systems tended to be within the same carrier, and you couldn't go like cross-carrier or cross-border. And it was early 2013 when Bitcoin kind of got on my radar for real. I'd previously seen it and was like, stupid fake internet money. Why does anybody want this? Why would they pay real dollars for this? And what finally clicked for me was the idea of having an open protocol for value exchange. Because I realized that these basic functions of receiving, storing, and sending value were something that can now be done with an open protocol. And it didn't matter where in the world you were, as long as you had an internet-connected device. And so it was reducing to zero marginal cost the ability to spin up a digital global bank account. And that struck me as just hugely, hugely powerful.
Right. I'd be interested in hearing a little bit more about your experience when you're traveling with the Grameen Foundation and also Kenya. So when you're saying that people in Kenya were using like mobile payments, what did that actually look like? Is it different to their actual base currency?
No, it was actually, you know, it was with Kenya shillings, and this was via essentially like sort of like SMS, but it was this kind of like SSD technology. So you kind of text-based interface, even on feature phones, which was really what was predominant at the time. It was kind of these kind of Nokia candy bar phones. So really pretty basic, but what's interesting is as much attention as microfinance has gotten. You know, Dr. Yunus won the Nobel Peace Prize for innovations with microfinance. When people say microfinance, what they're typically talking about is micro lending. And so that's the idea of lending very small amounts, like $20 or less even, largely to women, largely in developing countries. And the idea is that it gives people a little bit of credit. They're able to use that, you know, buy a cow, buy textiles to be able to like make some clothing, sell it, basically get a little business, like one person business going.
Yeah.
And it empowers people in that way. And while I do believe that opportunity and that choice is valuable, there are a lot of randomized control trials that have been done looking at microlending and finding that it's really hard to say that this is effective at helping people move out of poverty. Mm. It may be in some cases, but like net-net, it's pretty hard to find a strong effect. But there was great data showing that giving people access to essentially savings accounts was very effective. People can start to save. That is incredibly effective at helping them out of poverty. And so I think while we are in crypto today and in DeFi especially, getting into these ideas of like having lending and borrowing, and especially now starting to experiment with completely uncollateralized lending as well, doing more reputation-based. And that's great. Just that core ability to receive and securely store value is hugely powerful.
Right. And so you kind of have the penny drop moment and realize that there's kind of this, you know, potential for a global internet of money. What happens next?
Well, I was actually just planning to leave Grameen Foundation kind of as I was at that point and go to business school. And so I was starting at MIT in the fall doing my MBA. And I got there, I was like, okay, great. MIT, like Bitcoin, like where are my peeps? And there really was not much happening on campus in terms of Bitcoin. So I ended up very randomly. I woke up one day, checked Twitter on a weekend and saw one of my classmates was at this unconference at the MIT Status Center, which was just like kind of like attendee created agenda and sessions and everything. It's like, oh, this looks cool. So I was like, woke up, showered, like headed down and got there. And there was like a session on Bitcoin and it was standing room only. And I was like, okay, cool. So go in there. And I realized I knew more about Bitcoin than like even the person who was running the session. And I ended up answering a lot of questions and like there was so much interest. So then I was like, okay, I'm going to go to another session on this. And I just like spur of the moment registered like at MIT Bitcoin Club on Twitter. And like put that on the card. You needed like a Twitter handle on the card. And I was like, I'm going to just do this. And the next session was very well attended as well. Ended up really getting the club going. This was kind of fall of 2013. And then that spring, connected with this undergrad, Jeremy Rubin. He was a sophomore at the time. And he'd previously built a little Bitcoin project and gotten some attention for that. And we kind of talked once or twice, but he had this idea of giving $100 in Bitcoin to the undergrads. And I was like, yes, like let's go, let's do this. And we were very quickly able to find support from some MIT alums and people in the industry. We raised the money to be able to do this and announced it in the spring and just got like tons of attention. And in the fall, we actually ran a study with some professors who really helped us out on this and did this giveaway and a study attached to it where 70% of MIT undergrads opted in and participated and received $100 in Bitcoin. And this was at a time, it was fall 2014. Yeah. So Bitcoin was worth, it was somewhere in like the $325 to $425 range at the time. And it was just really cool to see this play out, where the goal here was not to get people to start spending Bitcoin or anything like this. The idea was, we really believed that Bitcoin had a good shot at like being the future of finance and the future of like where the world was heading. But the problem was there were no network effects.
Right.
And you couldn't find enough other people who accepted Bitcoin, who understood Bitcoin. And so the idea was, if we can actually take this really tight-knit community of very tech-forward young people and just let them assume that all of their peers have access to Bitcoin, can we kind of like get a glimpse into the future? And I think it was successful in that there were some awesome kind of core developer folks who kind of came out of that, and entrepreneurs who came out of that, and the MIT Digital Currency Initiative ended up emerging out of that as well. So just really very exciting about everything that came out of that. That also led me to my next step, which was I had some other Sloan alums who were at IDEO, which is a kind of global design firm. And they read about what we were doing and reached out. And I knew I wanted to just focus on Bitcoin. And there was kind of like nothing else that I could do when I graduated, because it was just too hard to focus on anything else. And I was like, okay, IDEO design firm, like Bitcoin, come on, no. But they convinced me that there was this really awesome culture there and design process that I thought could really help move the industry forward. And one of the reasons that I got so sold on this was I attended what they called a make-a-thon, which was basically a hackathon, an IDEO hackathon at the Harvard Innovation Lab. And I was like, okay, this is a blockchain hackathon. Like, let's go, let's check it out. And I showed up, and like, first of all, it was, I think, half or more women.
Right.
And just compared to what I've been able to do on the stuff we'd had at MIT, it was just like, whoa, wait, how is this possible? How did you get so many women to come to a blockchain hackathon? So, well, it's a make-a-thon, and it's not about Bitcoin or blockchains. It's about the future of trust, transactions, and reputation.
Mm.
And there was just this like light bulb for me of just how important the framing is in terms of who shows up and who gets involved. And I'd attended a bunch of hackathons, but this was probably the highest quality event I'd attended in terms of the actual things that were built and the ideas there, that probably 2/3 of them, maybe 3/4, had some really interesting insight. Maybe it wasn't a venture in and of itself, but there was like some kernel there that I was like, oh, that is worth poking on and seeing where this leads. And I just got sold. Joe Gerber and Matt Weiss just did an awesome job starting up this thing. And so there's this new group that ended up being called IDEO Collab that was doing this collaborative research and saying, what are blockchains good for other than Bitcoin? We know it's good for Bitcoin. What else can you do with a blockchain? And so it ended up being kind of this collaborative corporate R&D thing for a few years. And then in 2017, towards the end of the year, we started realizing we were meeting all these awesome startups, and there just wasn't a good way to support them with our model. IDEO has a very, you know, high-end consulting business that isn't really good for early stage startups. We had this kind of research type model that didn't really let us lean into them. And so we started, some of us there, just investing personal capital together. And we were lucky enough to find an awesome family office that also invested with us. And then we got a little bit of a track record that we go to IDEO leadership and say, hey, we want to like do this as a real fund. And they were luckily very forward thinking and open to this, and gave it their blessing and supported us to do it. And so we launched IDEO Collab Ventures. And then I spent the next 2.5 years as part of that team. We invested, and I think it was, you know, somewhere around 25 to 30 pre-seed, seed, and Series A startups in the crypto space, and just had a ton of fun with that. And that then led me to start Nascent this past fall.
Right. And we'll get into Nascent a bit later, but I guess, did you feel at the time of starting IDEO Collab, where obviously you were fairly instrumental in creating that firm, did you feel well-credentialed enough to kind of start what you were doing? It's obviously serious business, investing either your own capital or in, especially on behalf of others. Did you feel like you were in a good enough place to kind of make those sorts of calls?
Yeah, well, I think there's certainly a learning curve for all of this. And, you know, bless those LPs who are willing to take a chance on unproven investors. And, you know, we did have really relevant experience on the team in startups generally, and then in crypto specifically. And I think even at the time, there weren't a lot of people where we had the collective level of experience. I mean, that initial team, we had, you know, Joe Gerber, who had a lot of experience working with various startups at IDEO and you know, even prior to that. Ian Lee, who had been head of, you know, blockchain and crypto stuff at Citigroup for a number of years. Mm-hmm. Gavin McDermott, who was the first engineer at BitGo. Tara Tan, who had a lot of startup experience before and worked with a bunch of crypto startups with us at IDEO Colab. I'd been able to focus on nothing else for the prior few years and have the experience from MIT. So like we were pretty deep in early stage startups and in crypto, but we hadn't invested before. And so it was a leap. And I think, you know, luckily, I think we ended up doing a great job building up the firm and bringing in support from different places and put together a pretty phenomenal portfolio. But yeah, it was certainly a risk. And I think raising that first fund was harder because we didn't have somebody with venture experience specifically on that initial team.
Right. And that leads into Nascent, and you know, obviously eventually you had to make the call to move on. Speak to what Nascent's priorities are and I guess how they might be slightly different from IDEO Colab.
Yeah, I mean, so to be clear, I think the IDEO Colab team is fantastic and I consider them all, you know, very good personal friends and collaborators professionally too. Still done a number of deals with them since starting Nascent. And I'd say there are just some inherent challenges in the traditional, you know, kind of close-ended venture fund structure. And we're starting to see more and more firms flex that structure a little bit to be able to do a few additional things that you can't typically do in these kind of like long-term venture structures. And I think with the IDEO Colab Ventures, you know, fund, it's attached to IDEO. And there are certain considerations and just, you know, brand things that go along with being attached to this storied firm. And the goal with Nascent was really just to have immense flexibility and just build from scratch, from the ground up, say, how do you build a really crypto native firm and one that can evolve over time? Because at the time in, you know, early 2018, when we were getting started with IDEO Colab Ventures, one of our questions was, do you do a closed-ended venture fund or this kind of like open-ended hedge fund structure? And which was more appropriate? And it was really like, okay, for equity versus tokens and stuff being liquid, like what are you going to trading on some stuff? Like what makes more sense? And like nobody at the time was thinking at all about kind of like yield farming and mm-hmm. like all these like different strategies, like the grayscale carry trade, and like all these different things that you could potentially do. It just wasn't even on people's radar. And so even if you were being pretty forward thinking at the time, very few people had fund documents that would permit them to engage these new activities. They would have to, if they were going to do them, wait till their next fund, revise the documents, and be able to get those capabilities. And so with Nascent, we basically said, like, it's all on the table. Like, here's the things we're doing now, but we're not giving any restrictions in terms of how we can deploy capital and spend our time. And we actually haven't raised external capital. It's all, you know, from the members of the team have contributed to it. And so that lets us be incredibly flexible, not worry that we're going to scare away LPs who would invest in the fund. We can just do what we think is best. And we don't really have as much of a principal agent problem in that sense.
How would you comment on how the kind of the financing dynamic has developed?
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly a lot of capital looking to invest in deals right now. It's certainly just much, much higher than it was at any point prior, including even in 2017. So it's very competitive. We're seeing valuations go up, just getting allocations and rounds can be challenging. But one of the interesting things, I think there are more funds in a similar vein to Nascent where they don't have external LPs, or maybe they've got one external LP, and they're just able to be really flexible and really aggressive. I think folks mm-hmm. like Framework and CMS and Mechanism are just, and Delphi Digital are just really doing a great job kind of carving out these leading roles. Just folks want to work with them, and I think that's fantastic. And then you see some of the larger existing funds, you know, you see the the paradigms, and Andreessen Horowitz and Pantera and Polychain and Dragonfly and Electric Capital, like Standard Crypto, like all these folks got these like multiple $100 million funds there that they're looking to deploy largely into venture. And I think that's driven up, you know, valuations and round sizes. And it's a fantastic time to be a founder. I think it's hard to stay focused, but there, you know, there was that period in kind of 2018, 2019, where there wasn't as much capital going around, and it could be very hard to get funding for a lot of early stage crypto ventures. And now it's not hard. And so I think that's great. You know, we're going to see stuff that's funded at a level that just really shouldn't be. We're going to see things that shouldn't be funded at all get funded. But end of the day, like there is going to be more innovation and more growth coming out of this. And so it's, you know, my job as an investor in this space to, you know, try to keep this, you know, larger perspective and think about, you know, where we are in the cycle and try to be, you know, somewhat valuation conscious.
Sure.
But I think overall, it's just it's a big plus for the space in terms of just ability to move forward and advance.
Right. And I guess, you know, over the course of 20, there are a number of very interesting experiences, experiments in DeFi particularly, one of which that you were involved in was Yam Finance.
Yep.
So maybe tell a bit of a story from the inside as to how interesting that might have been from you and what the experience was like seeing, I guess, the value flood into the, you know, the contracts that, you know, you helped deploy.
Yeah. So Yam was a crazy, crazy experience. So this actually came about with working with a few folks who we were actually talking about, like working together and them potentially joining what came to be Nascent. And it was just kind of like, had this idea for something. It was basically the idea was to like be a better version of Ampleforth. The idea being like, let's take that rebasing mechanism. You slap on the ability to like create a reserve behind that to kind of create a, almost like a floor on it. And what could it do? And then we were inspired by obviously Yearn and the way they did the Fair launch and wanted to do governance and just kind of, it was a 10-day project from idea to launch. And we did have some very, very well-respected folks look over the code before we put it live. But yeah, we did not expect it to do anything close to what it ended up doing. And it was both really exciting and really scary. And then when that bug was found by Brock, Elmore was the you know, lead, really the solo dev on that. And, and he was the one who found it in his own code. It was just like, man, that sucked. And then we thought we had a rescue. We thought we, like, if we rallied the community on this like global basis in less than 24 hours, that we could actually save Yam before this inflation bug kicked in. And everyone rallied and we got there and we were like over the moon excited. And then like, as we were talking about it again, Brock was the one who found like, it doesn't matter. Like we were actually just completely screwed before we even started. And like, it didn't matter that we got over the line. And it was just, it was so awful to feel that. And just really, it was like feeling like letting everyone down because we like that everyone had just like rallied behind this group and like this project, like rescue this project. And it ultimately hadn't been meaningful to be able to get over that threshold. That said, you know, major kudos to Brock and Trent and also Will Price, who helped really stay with it and guide it and get it back, get it audited and relaunched. But one of the things that I think is coolest is, you know, as someone who helped design some of those initial core mechanisms, what I thought we were building and what Yam became are two completely different things. And there were even differences like on the team. And this idea of a DAO that was using a treasury to like fund different projects and grow it. That was not at all what I thought we were building. But I think that just shows how decentralized it is. Like, literally, I don't know any other project. Maybe there are some now, but especially at the time, like this was literally on-chain governed from launch. Literally before the first token was issued, there was no administrative control, which was incredibly reckless, right? We should have known better, but like there was literally no control. We had no control over it. And as soon as that first token was minted, the entire system was governed by those tokens. And I think that was really cool. And I think it was a little underappreciated aspect of it at the time as to like how different that was from how projects had been launched up to that point.
Right. And to what extent was the motivation to, I guess, engage in that sort of an experiment versus did you think that it was actually, you know, the project was ostensibly providing a better version of Ampleforth, like you said? And also comment on there's speculation that the name YAM is derived from Yearn plus Ampleforth. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah. it was like right. Yearn, Ampleforth, Yample, YAM. And I think it was like a day or two into the like work on the project where someone was like, guys, there's a YAM emoji. And we were just like, oh, wow. Wow. And so, yeah, definitely mixed feelings about the whole, you know, vegetable farming memes and stuff that ended up coming out of that. But I do think it also just like it brought some fun into it and just like this like level of irreverence, and maybe a little more reverence would have been justified. But like, you know, when we look back at the kind of the arc of DeFi and how this ecosystem and industry has evolved, I feel very proud to have been part of getting that out there and kind of changing how people were doing projects. Like, yeah, it got a little crazy with how some people were doing some of this yield farming stuff, but generally speaking, like I feel like it was really a pivotal point in how DeFi has evolved. And again, especially Brock and Trent, like huge kudos to them. Clinton Bembry also, who is the designer on the team, and he did the front interface that like, I don't know how many hundreds or thousands of projects have forked that UI, but like I've never seen an interface go so viral and just get like reused across so many things before. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah, I was about to say, like, experiments in crypto and DeFi have such a strong place because, as you said, to build the new financial system, it does require iterations and sometimes pushing of boundaries, but those pushing of boundaries is ultimately what helps the whole system grow as a whole.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, there's great discussion to be had about like, what's the right way to do that, you know, safely. Like, we don't want people to be afraid to take risks, but like, what's the right way to communicate risks, or I think useful friction in some of these things. In some ways, I think YAM got so crazy because Clinton had such a great interface that it was just like too easy.
Right.
And I think ultimately, do we want all these tools to be super easy to use? Like long run, yes, right? If we're going to reach billions of people and have this be the backbone of the global financial system, there need to be easy interfaces. That said, I think we're still at a level where for somebody who is like relying on savings to like they're living on a few dollars a day, even assuming gas fees were like next to zero again, the idea of the saying you should trust your life savings into these systems, I just don't think we're there yet. And I think there are some protocols that are getting pretty robust that I think are more worthy of trust. It still makes me very uncomfortable. The good news is we've got billions of dollars of super high risk capital that is battle testing these systems and is providing these multi-billion dollar bug bounties to harden them and find the bugs. And I think that is fantastic, right? That is, you know, where we want like all this money, like the risk coming in, we're going to test it, we're going to harden it, and then it will be for everybody to use. But right now, it's great that there are high returns that is drawing in all that risk capital so that we can get to that point.
Absolutely. And maybe that's a good sort of jumping off point for you to explain what's next. I guess what's next for Nascent? What's next for you?
So we've kind of gotten started working with some very early stage teams and trying to support them in various ways. There's advising and helping with hiring and marketing and strategy and fundraising and different things. And we certainly help with that. We also have a very close relationship with Open Zeppelin, one of the top audit firms. We help our portfolio companies through that process. We're not live now, and we'll be announcing before this is published that Brock Elmore has actually joined our team as our chief architect and is building a lot of the technology. He's also helping to work with some of our portfolio companies as well. He's beyond Yam. He's contributed code behind the scenes to some of the top projects in the ecosystem and just has a lot of experience and knowledge of these systems. And we're building out more kind of trade infrastructure and ability. We are deploying, the majority of our capital is actively deployed in DeFi. And so we are literally daily users of, well over a dozen protocols. And I think that just helps us understand what's going on a lot better. We're able to use them. We're excited about using them. We're able to generate great returns off that. But I think it also really helps us on the venture side when we're looking at these early teams and we're helping them think through different paths they can take with their products and their protocols, because we can say hey, we are going to be a power user of your protocol in a lot of cases. And so we can tell you what we like, what we don't like, how maybe to tweak it. Is there a way that folks with a lot of capital might try to lean on the system and potentially break it? We've actually, even outside of audits, we've helped uncover some flaws in the code and some projects that we've been working with. And that's something that, I'm proud of us doing, that we really get in the weeds with teams and aren't just going to write a check and say, see you later. We really want to be very hands-on and helpful.
Yeah, I was about to say that seems to be a reoccurring theme through your story. When you're at MIT, you started up the Bitcoin Club. You've always been very low to the ground level. And I guess that also shows through your investing style at Nascent as well, just a ground level approach, being really close to the team.
Yeah, I mean, we do invest in, public projects that have, multi-hundred million or multi-billion dollar valuations even. We hold a lot of Bitcoin, a lot of ETH too. We can do it all, but really what I enjoy and what a lot of folks on the team enjoy is just that very early stage and helping projects get off on the right foot or navigate and figure out how to get to that next level.
Right. Why is it that you enjoy that?
It's a good question. I think it's a point of high leverage. You can make a bigger difference in the trajectory of a team and of a protocol by being involved at that early stage. I think that we are involved. So Balancer is one that I work closely with the Balancer team as well, and they're slightly more mature protocol, but and I think there is still the ability to have impact with something like that. But early on, it's a lot of fun. Like you mentioned, I've throughout my career been early in kind of starting various projects and groups, and I enjoy that startup phase. And I've now been involved with enough projects to start seeing some patterns and having lessons learned that have been we had pain here, let's try to avoid that again. Or this worked well, let's make sure you construct your community this way, or you think about token distribution or vesting in this way. And I think it's honestly, it's just the most fun for me. And so, I've throughout my career, it hasn't been like a strategic career where I'm like, I'm going to do this so I can get to this, so I can get to this. I've been very fortunate in that just following my interests and my passions have just led me to some amazing opportunities and some great places. And, you know, I know that that's not an experience that everybody is able to have. And I feel very fortunate that, that, you know, it's worked out for me thus far.
Right. And where can people go and find you to learn more?
You can learn more about Nascent at nascent.xyz or at nascentxyz on Twitter. I'm at Dielitzer on Twitter. You can find me there.
Well, Dan, thanks for the time today.
Thanks so much, guys.
Thanks for joining this Koji conversation. To continue the conversation offline, DM us on Twitter at @Koji_capital or reach out to us via email, hello@Koji.capital, or jump into our Discord linked in our bio.